So, Ronnie, this is the place you are probably thinking of. Mindfulness of breathing is peaceful and sublime. Can you see that? It's a little bit too small. This is the Vinaya Pitaka version of the Anapanasati Sutta. So, anyway, yeah. You okay, Ronnie? Yeah? Okay, good. Yep. So, all right. So let's carry on. So we're going to look now at the last four steps of the Anapanasati Sutta, and these are often called the insight steps. Four steps that focus on contemplating impermanence, essentially. In other words, the three characteristics of existence, if you like. So let's see what it has to say about this. So then after you come out of the jhana state, where even if you haven't gone all the way to jhana, whatever, however far you have come, then you can use the insight contemplations that come now. So the practice like this. I'll breathe in observing impermanence. The practice like this. I'll breathe out observing impermanence. The practice like this. I'll breathe in observing fading away. The practice like this, I'll breathe out, observing fading away. The practice like this, I'll breathe in, observing cessation. The practice like this, I'll breathe out, observing cessation. The practice like this, I'll breathe in, observing letting go. The practice like this, I'll breathe out, observing letting go. Yeah, so here we have four things. We have impermanence. We have fading away, we have cessation, and we have letting go. And all of these four things are really about impermanence. Yeah, these are degrees of impermanence. The first one is just anicca, just ordinary impermanence. In other words, changeability, that things are changing. The second one, fading away, means that impermanence has a certain direction to it. The direction of fading away, the direction of becoming less. Yeah, so that's a kind of particular kind of, it's not just changing up and down, it has a declining effect to it, fading away. Cessation is the final, the kind of highest kind of impermanence, when things disappear completely, that's a very high degree of impermanence. And the last one, letting go, which is patinisagga in Pali, means that you let it go because it is impermanent. And by letting it go, it then disappears, right? It is no longer a problem for you, huh? And so it is gone from your mind because you no longer crave and you no longer have any attachment to it. So these are the four kinds of contemplation. So the question then arises, what are we contemplating in this way? What is the thing that we are contemplating? It doesn't really say. So what you are contemplating, of course, is the process that you have been through. The main point of that process is the breath meditation itself. But all the things that are part of that process is what you contemplate now. And if you think back on that process, depending on how deep you go, you will have seen the changeability of things, how things are moving. But you're very important, you will have seen the fading away of a large number of things. For example, as you go through this process, the body is fading away, they're becoming less and less prominent, going into the background until eventually the body ceases completely when you enter a jhana state. The five senses are gradually becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. They are fading away until eventually they cease when you enter the jhana state. The will, in other words, the stillness is becoming stronger and stronger, and because the stillness is becoming stronger, the will or the doing activity of the mind is actually gradually fading away until it ceases when you enter the jhana state. The hindrances of the mind are fading away. The mind is becoming clearer and clearer and more powerful. Certain feelings are fading away. Yeah, the bad feelings are fading away. the certain happy feelings are gradually fading away, and you're left with bliss as you enter the jhanas. You can contemplate the feelings in that way. Perceptions are fading away. The whole world is fading away. The perceptions are becoming simpler and simpler. There's less and less left over. Perceptions are fading away as you go through this. And a large number of perceptions cease, until the only perception that is left in the jhana state is the perception of bliss and vitakka vichara. And so in this way you can see how there's a large number of phenomena through this process that are, first you can see them as impermanent, and then you can see them as fading away and disappearing. And eventually, as you keep on doing this, the more you see that things completely cease and they come to an end, there comes a point when you realize that these things are not worthy of holding on to anymore. Why? Because when things disappear, you understand things fully. When they are gone, you understand the nature of dukkha, because when they're gone, you feel happy. If something is gone and you feel happy without it, well, actually it must be dukkha. What you have now is happy. So you understand the body is dukkha, five senses are dukkha, the will is dukkha, etc., etc. So you understand dukkha as you do this. You also understand non-self. So you understand all the three characteristics. And the reason why you understand non-self is that when you enter deep states of samadhi, you no longer have access to these things. You can no longer access the body. And the things that you cannot access, they are by definition non-self. Anything which is self must be accessible. That's kind of the because you have to be in control of those things. So through this process, you are seeing not just impermanence, the full impermanence of cessation, but you also understand dukkha and also non-self. And for that reason, the very last step then is the letting go, because when you see these things in this way, you understand that they are not really interesting at all. And they become like a hot coal. You're grasping onto hot coals. Why am I grasping hot coal? Let go. It's automatic. You don't have to think that you have to let go. It just happens automatically because you understand, you see with insight that you are grasping dukkha, you're grasping suffering. And that's kind of madness to grasp suffering, so you let it go. This is the process of insight. And to some extent, this is a little bit what I'm trying to do at the end of each meditation session, is to kind of contemplate a little bit on how the process works. This is obviously more profound, but by starting to get into the habit of contemplating a little bit, you start to see how this contemplation happens. How does the meditation work? And then you gradually turn that into understanding the things that are ceasing and disappearing down the track. But for this process to be powerful, the meditation has to be quite strong already. Otherwise, it's not going to have too much effect. So it has to be fairly peaceful and calm already for this really to have some, otherwise it's not going to, the mind is just going to shrug and, okay, doesn't understand what's happening here. So this is the process of Anapanasati, all the way down to the very end of what is happening here. The last four steps, which are all about insight steps. So let's go back to the sutta we originally were on. It's not actually in that booklet, because the booklet is missing a large part of this. So let's go back to the sutta we were on. So you can see in this sutta, it is all contracted down. It's contracted from breathing heavily all the way to letting go. It's contracted with three dots. So you don't get to see it. That's why I went to the other sutta. Okay, so then the Buddha says that is how the samadhi, due to mindfulness of breathing, when developed and cultivated, is very fruitful and very beneficial. That is the definition of fruitful and beneficial. It takes you basically all the way to the end of the path. Patinisagga, letting go, is really the end of the path there. Okay. I'm a little bit afraid of going too fast, because there's a lot of information here crammed into a short period of time. But the retreat is coming to an end, so we probably have to go fast. There's no choice. So, okay. Now we come to the reason why I was using the sutta is for this reason here, because now, before my awakening again. Before my awakening, when I was still unawakened, but intent on awakening, I too usually practice this kind of meditation. Usually here, bahulang. Bahulam is often. So I frequently practice this meditation. Yeah. So this is the place in the suttas where the Buddha to be says, or the Buddha says that he also practiced anapanasati to achieve awakening. Yeah. So that's kind of nice. We often hear that, but actually this is the only place in the suttas where it says that, I think, specifically. So this is the practice of the Buddha. And I think there is something very interesting about the idea of anapanasati that makes it very powerful. And I think one of the reasons why it is powerful is because that it is a very natural thing. It's a naturally occurring phenomenon. Yeah, it is always there, easy to get hold of. And it's nothing fancy. It is not a lot of imagination. You don't have to create all kind of things in your mind. It's down to earth. It grounds you, brings you back to reality. Some of these meditations that you hear about, they are very fancy kind of meditations. And I think there is a danger with fancy meditations, that they can take you astray, they can lead you on the wrong path, because you can actually get a little bit deluded when you start imagining all kind of things. The less you imagine, the more down to earth it is, the more healthy kind of meditation I think it is. And this is anapanasati, very down to earth, very healthy, very natural. And I think this is the power of this particular practice. And also, of course, the fact that it can take you all the way to awakening, which is really amazing for such a humble thing as the breath. Then he says, the Buddha, he says, and while I was usually practicing this kind of meditation, neither my body nor my eyes became fatigued or strained. So what is this all about? That sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? So what does it mean? My body did not become fatigued. And one way of thinking about the body not becoming fatigued is that he is no longer doing the ascetic practices. Yeah, because a very large part of what he was doing before was ascetic practices. And he was calling that, also he called those practices a kind of meditation. It's called the apanaka jhana. Apanaka means non-breathing jhana. And this was because he was holding his breath. That became the non-breathing meditation. And that was fatiguing for the body. He exhausted his body because of that. So that is my preferred understanding of that. The commentary says it has to do more with body contemplation in terms of the four elements, that sort of thing. I'm not sure exactly why that would fatigue the body, but that's kind of the commentarial understanding. And then you have the idea of my eyes did not become fatigued. So what is that all about? It sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? What has it got to do with the eyes? And my guess here, and this is confirmed by the commentary, is that this has to do with the kasina meditations. Kasinas mean totalities, and this is where you have a disc of a color disc, or a disc of earth, or a disc of space, or whatever, and you focus your attention on that disc, and then that becomes eventually an image in the mind, that disc, and then it takes you into the jhana. And this was one of the ways of meditating apparently that existed before the Buddha, that the Buddha then may have used also as part of his practice. But it has the downside, it says here, that your eyes become fatigued, yeah, because you're staring at this disc all the time. And after a while, your eyes, they rebel, they don't want to stare at this disc anymore. And they say, we want to rest, please, do mindfulness of breathing. Okay, mindfulness of breathing. Yeah. And this is what the Buddha does, because he wants to spare his eyes from all of this staring at these discs of colors, kasinas. I think that's probably right. It's a little bit strange, right? Because it comes out of the blue like that. And the Buddha doesn't really say anywhere that he practices the kasinas. But anyway, there you are. Sometimes there are some random things in the suttas and you're not really sure exactly what is going on there. So, anyway, let's carry on, because I'm not sure how interesting that is, even though it's there. And my mind was freed from the defilements by not grasping. Yeah. So this is another result of mindfulness of breathing. Yeah? Your eyes are not fatigued, the body is not fatigued, And then the mind is freed through non-grasping from the defilements. So that is the kind of the main part of that sutta, and now comes all the benefits that comes from mindfulness of breathing. So the long list of benefits coming up now next, and we'll have a very quick look at those benefits because they are a little bit interesting. So let's have a quick look at them now. Now, a mendicant might wish, may neither my body nor my eyes become fatigued, and may my mind be freed from the defilements by not grasping. So let them closely focus on this immersion or this samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. Yeah, so if you want to have your asavas destroyed, the defilements destroyed, then the way to do it, according to this, is to do mindfulness of breathing. So these are all the benefits that come from mindfulness of breathing. Number one, you become an arahant. That's a pretty good benefit right there. Now, a mendicant might wish, may I give up memories and thoughts of the lay life. Let them focus closely on the samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. So now we're talking about someone who has gone forth, a bhikkhu, and you want to abandon the memories, the sada sankappa, and intentions based on lay life. This is one of the things, you know, as a monastic, this is one of the things you have to give up, those memories, because these are the things that can always draw you back again into lay life if you don't actually gradually abandon them. And these are all kinds of desires and things and longings that you may find hard to give up. So all of those things are given up through mindfulness of breathing. And again, it's because when you stay with the breath, then you are cutting the ability of the mind to sustain those thoughts, and also you're experiencing an alternative bliss instead, which takes the place of that bliss of the household life. So, sada sankappa of the household life, gehasita is the household life here, are abandoned. So that's comes in handy, especially if you're a monastic. I'm not sure if you're a lay person, it might be a bit different, when you are on retreat, it comes in handy to do that. Now, a mendicant might wish, may I meditate perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive. Let them focus on the samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. So the idea here is that anything in the world can be regarded either as repulsive or unrepulsive. We looked before at the triad, the asada, adinava, and nisarana, which is like the gratification and the drawbacks, and then the liberation from things, And everything in the world can be regarded from those angles of asada, adinava, and nisarana. And the repulsive and the unrepulsive here are similar to that, The apatikula, repulsive, is similar to the adinava. If you see the drawback and the downside strongly, it leads to patikula. You are repelled by something. And the apatikula usually means that you are attracted to something, you're not repelled. And so this is the mind of the arahant, or someone who's practicing really well. You can look at anything in the world and you can choose your perception. Do you want to choose to look at the downside or the upside of something? And so you can look at the person and you can see something repulsive, or you can see something attractive, depending on what you want to look at. And anything in the world you can see in that way. You can take a cold shower and you can feel it as delightful or as unpleasant. And of course, here in Malaysia, cold showers are not really cold. They are kind of still quite pleasant. In some places, you have to kind of hack a hole in the ice to dive in. That's when it's really cold. And you have to make sure you find that hole again afterwards. You go under the ice, you have a problem otherwise. This happens, right? This is not a joke. People do that. There's a lake, and you want to go bathing in the lake. You hack a hole in the ice, and then you kind of dive into the hole. This is kind of happens in some of these crazy countries where I come from. Probably in Switzerland as well, people probably do this kind of thing. So sometimes it's the Northern European delights. The Russians are famous for these kind of things. Russia is very cold. But anyway, this ability to perceive the world as you like, yet shifting your perception very, very quickly is what this is about. It can be very useful. Now, a mendicant might wish, may I meditate perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive. So if something is terrible and something is really awful, you actually don't see the repulsive in it. You actually see it as okay. Yeah, for example, you might see a corpse that is being eaten by maggots. And this is the thing we see in Bodhinyana Monastery quite often, because you see the kangaroos. They die everywhere, left, right and center. They are dead kangaroos. There's so many kangaroos in the monastery that they have to die of old age sometimes or whatever. And then the maggots come and they start, and it kind of can be incredibly repulsive, especially the smell is absolutely terrible. But then the ability to then shift your perception, yeah? Actually, it's a peaceful perception because it counteracts any desire and delights and these kind of things. Then you see the non-repulsive aspect even in something as disgusting as a kangaroo being eaten alive by maggots. That can also be useful, right? Shifting your perceptions at ease, the more profound your meditation is. A mendicant might wish, may I meditate perceiving the repulsive in the repulsive and the repulsive. So let them focus closely on the samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. And this just means that sometimes what you're looking at has both aspects at the same time. You can overcome both aspects and just see the repulsive. Similar one, I think. May I meditate perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive and the unrepulsive. Use mindfulness of breathing here. You can see how you become a master of perception. You can see things exactly the way you like to see them. Very flexible mind. When an arahant, there are no hindrances in the mind. The hindrances are what make the mind unresponsive, unflexible. When we have no hindrances, the mind is incredibly flexible. In the sutta, there's a word for this. It's called kammaniya and mudu. Kammaniya means workable. Mudu means soft. Yeah, and pliable is another word for this. When you come out of the jhana states, the mind is incredibly pliable and workable. You can use it whatever way you like. It becomes a tool in your hands. Minds of most people, because of defilements in the mind is often hard and it's not really flexible and doesn't really move, doesn't do what you want it to do. If you tell the mind to watch the breath, the mind doesn't watch the breath. It goes thinking about dinner or something instead. You know what I mean? This is a mind which is not pliable. It is not workable. You don't have control over your mind. The mind just does its own thing. So having control of the mind is kind of nice. Yeah, watch the breath. Okay, like a nice dog. Watching the breath, right? Following along. You want to have a mind like a dog. Yeah? Do this. Okay, dog, get the bone. Dog, duk, 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 gets the bone. Yeah? You're very happy. This is kind of the ideal mind. Does exactly what you want it to do. All right. Now, a mendicant might wish, may I meditate staying equanimous, mindful, and aware, rejecting both the repulsive and the unrepulsive. The sutta has lots of repulsive and unrepulsive in it. So you just stay equanimous, yeah? You're mindful and aware. This is kind of the higher kind of state. These are the things what you really want to do. This is where you're talking about the profound jhana states, where everything is equanimous. Equanimity is this idea of looking on. Upeka literally means to look on. So it's a pekati together with upa prefix. It means to look on. And the idea is that when the mind looks on with perfect equanimity, the mind is what they call anenja. It is imperturbable. It means that it cannot be worked up. It cannot be thrown off balance. It cannot be disturbed by anything it sees. It is incredibly powerful. And that is why the fourth jhana is the place where you can have the best insight, because the mind can deal with anything that comes its way. The most difficult things to see are things like non-self, but even non-self can be seen from the vantage point of the fourth jhana, because the mind is perfectly stable and can deal with anything. So upeka is one of these very powerful high qualities of the mind that we are seeking to establish. Let them focus on samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. Now a mendicant might wish, okay, so now we're getting into the jhana states next. Okay, let's just take a short meditation break and we can come back to the jhanas. Okay, any comments, questions? At the front.
Can I clarify the one of the stages is breathing in and out, freeing the mind, so that's entering the jhana. Okay. So then after that, the process is automatic?
After that, you can't do anything, because in the jhana state, you are locked into the state. So the freeing is the last thing you do, and then you enter the jhana. That's the very, very last bit you do as you enter the jhana state. Yeah.
Okay, and also, Ajahn, you mentioned that there will be an explosive bliss when entering the jhana, right? Is it like that every time? Every time you enter the jhana, is it like that?
The jhana state is a kind of a standard. It's the same state pretty much every time, yeah? So it is, it's kind of be the most powerful bliss you have ever experienced, but you're building it up, building it up, building it up, and then you enter the jhana. It's like the culmination of that building up, yeah, when you get there. Always be the same, yeah.
So can one fall out of the jhana upon entering?
Can you fall out of it?
Entering properly.
Yes, you can. Sometimes jhanas, because they are a bit, it can like be unstable, because it is. It can be, maybe you're a bit worried or fearful or something, so you kind of go almost in, but not quite, and then you kind of fall out again. That can happen. But usually when you enter a jhana, usually you stay for quite long periods of time, usually, when you enter it properly. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Ajahn.
Yeah.
Ajahn, I don't understand. This is some years back. I was in a Vipassana retreat.
Yeah.
After 2 days or so, everybody has aches and pains all over.
Yeah.
Not necessarily from posture. So,
yeah.
And then, I also have aches and pains. Then, sometime later, I was doing meditation, metta.
Yeah.
At that time, I was having shoulder ache due to exercise. Surprisingly, only after 15 minutes of metta, the aches are gone. How come one meditation bring out aches, another one suppress aches?
How come one teaching that you should go
in
with
Vipassana,
the
aches and pains arises.
Yeah, yeah.
The, in metta, the aches and pains are gone.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's because you are, it can be many reasons for that, but because Vipassana is often going to the feelings in the body, you're deliberately focusing on the feelings, so you will feel it very prominently. But when you're doing metta, you're focusing on something else, you're focusing on the positive feelings. And because you're focusing on the positive feelings, the negative feelings tend to disappear. So it depends on what you're focusing. The same thing here with the breath. If when this breath meditation becomes very profound, you can't really feel the body anymore. That's why the aches and pains are gone, because the body fades into the background. And with the metta, with any kind of deep meditation, the body tends to feel really at ease and really relaxed. This is the beauty of this thing. So it actually is not only that you're suppressing the feelings, but actually the feelings dissolve somehow through the power of the mind, and then they're no longer there. So when you come out afterwards of the metta or the samadhi, actually the body is really relaxed and really at ease. There's no pains anymore. So it is all this focusing on it, which is the pain, which is the problem sometimes.
Ajahn? Here.
Where?
I'm here.
There, okay.
Ajahn, just now when you mentioned the 16 stages of anapanasati, because the text we have here is not in sequence, so may I know, when you look at the screen, which sutta you're referring to?
I'm looking at Majjhimanikaya 118.
Oh, okay.
This one here, this is where it has all the stages. This is the standard, this is the Anapanasati Sutta, the main one. MN 118.
Okay, thank you, Ajahn.
Mindfulness of breathing, there you are.
Viraga Anupassi, in the fourth tetrad, Viraga Anupassi, what is the literal meaning of Viraga? here it is translated as fading away. Could there be what is the literal meaning?
Viraga has two meanings. One is the opposite of raga, and raga is like desire. So viraga is very often translated as dispassion. Dispassion meaning non-desire is a very common translation for viraga. But viraga also has the meaning of fading away. Both of those are literal meanings of the word viraga, has both of those meanings. So the context decides which one is the right meaning. So here, because we're talking about impermanence, it is fading away. It seems to be the right meaning in this context. Yeah.
But viraga, this passion could be understood as a result of understanding of seeing impermanence, right?
Yeah, so it could. I mean, you could argue that this passion also fits the context reasonably well. It can be used as well, in the sense that when you feel dispassionate towards something, because fading away and dispassion are also closely related, right? Because when you are dispassionate, things fade away, and when they fade away, well, it's usually because of dispassion. So they obviously are linked to each other in a certain way. So yes,
I have this problem when I meditate, right? When I try to tend to too relax, too calm.
Yeah.
Because I have this sleep apnea problem.
Okay.
So basically, there's moment that I don't breathe.
Uh-huh.
So, and then I take a deep breath again.
Yeah.
Then it sounds like everything starts to come back all of a sudden, and then you start to start from all over again.
Okay.
Yeah, how do I overcome this?
Don't know. Maybe do some other meditation. Do some metta meditation or something instead, you know? Because if the breath is a problem, it might be better to do some other meditation. Try metta. Try some guided metta meditation and see if that works. That can take you very deep as well if you can make it actually work for you. See if we can make that work, and next year come back if it doesn't work at all. We'll talk about it.
Good afternoon, Ajahn.
Yes, where are you?
I'm here.
There, okay. Because the loudspeaker is somewhere else, and I can't. No, I have no idea where you are, so okay. Please, go for it. Yeah.
There are two questions.
Yeah.
One of which is, when I go into meditation, sometimes I'm unaware whether I'm actually dozing off or I'm actually meditating, because I have snippets of moments where I lose the senses.
Yeah.
And after which I regain again. I regain those senses again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one question. And another one was, I thought I experienced mimitta during Ajahn Brahm's retreat last year.
Yeah.
I was meditating and I started to see bright lights that were moving vigorously.
Yeah. Okay.
And being very new to it, I started following it, chasing it. And okay. Suddenly I just felt there is this really hot and burning sensation that was rising from the back of my neck all the way to the head. And I experienced migraine for 2 days.
Wow, okay.
That disturbed my meditation since then.
Yeah.
Thank you. Can I understand what should I do, or what happens?
Okay.
Thank you.
So, with the first one, you just have to, if you have doubts of whether you're falling asleep or not, you have to kind of brighten up the mind a little bit, make it more bright. There's a kind of brightness and the gladness that is missing, in a sense. And when the mind is kind of a little bit kind of neutral, sometimes it can kind of be very, very little distance between mindfulness and kind of being dull and falling asleep, and that's kind of the problem. So you want to energize the mind, and the energy comes from happiness and joy. So you want to use some of these techniques that we talked about before to bring energy and joy to the mind, one way or another, and then you will know that you are awake. The idea is to be as brightly awake as you possibly can. That's powerful mindfulness. When you do that. So try to bring some more joy in there, and then keep on experimenting, keep on looking at the meditation. As you do that, you will start to find that balance where it actually works in the right way. So, it is quite common to fall into this thing they call Mitra Samadhi, where you go into some kind of stillness, but actually you have no awareness, and kind of time just goes by and nothing really happens, and it's kind of a waste of time, to be honest. And this other thing about the bright lights, and you're following the bright lights, and you have a headache, a migraine for a few days afterwards. What you have to do is remember that it should all be relaxed, the meditation here. And probably at that point, your mind was kind of getting really kind of excited and out of control, and then kind of that was kind of part of the problem there. So when the lights are moving, instead of following the lights, go back to the breath and wait till the light stabilizes. It's a stable light that is powerful, because it's stability and peace that we're trying to achieve on this thing here. So stay with the breath a little bit longer until you get a nimitta which really is stable. That's the nimitta you want to have. The moving can be too distracting for the mind. So basically that's, I think, the answer to that question there. Yeah.
Hi, Ajahn. I have questions on the equanimous state.
Equanimous state, okay.
Yeah. At the last state. How does being equanimous sit with this rejecting both the repulsive and the unrepulsive? Because rejecting seems to be like very like you need to exert to reject.
Let's see what the Pali says, because the Pali usually gives us the clue as to what is going on. So let's have a quick look. Pali. Rejecting. So the Pali is abhinivajetva. So I think it probably means something like avoiding, to be honest, rather than rejecting. Yeah. So this is the problem with translation. You don't really know exactly what's going on. I think abhinivajetva usually means avoiding. Yeah. Yeah. So you don't usually have a very strong, you don't have a strong sense of rejection, but you just avoid it. In other words, you put your attention somewhere else. Yeah.
And also coming back to this equanimous state, I think four steps before, you did mention something about dulling of the mind. So what is the difference between that dull mind and the equanimous? You know what I mean?
The difference is enormous, because when you are equanimous in this way, you are very, very sharp. Yeah, the mindfulness, this is actually the highest kind of mindfulness you can have. Mindfulness is super strong. You're going through the jhanas, right? One after the other. We come to that now. And this is really the kind of equanimity that is based on the third or the fourth jhana state. The mind is going to be very, very powerful, very clear. Lots of energy in the mind, but an equanimous kind of energy here, rather than an energy which is blissful.
Okay, so the earlier stage where there is a dulling of the mind, it is a necessary step. Is that what it means?
No, you want to avoid the dullness. Yeah, so dullness is to be avoided. But it is something most people will go through, because it's a very common thing to have, dullness. So it's something you have to learn to deal with. So it's not necessary, but you have to learn to deal with it usually. Yeah. Okay, let's carry on a little bit. So we are coming toward the end of this. So now we come into the jhana state, and they're kind of interesting here. So now a mendicant might wish, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, may I enter and remain in the first absorption, the first jhana, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion while placing the mind and keeping it connected. So this is the first jhana. This is what you enter as you are freeing the mind towards this 12th, after the 12th step of the Anapanasati Sutta. And again, you will see here, it's quite secluded from the five senses. You have the kamehi, the plural over there, means the five senses. And then you have the unskillful qualities. These are the five hindrances, which includes sensual desire, which is completely gone at this point. Entering the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion. The point here is that as you go through the meditation, you go through a large number of degrees of bliss and happiness. Yeah, we have seen this in the Anapanasati Sutta, where you have one bliss and then a higher bliss and then even more bliss one after the other. But then when you enter the first jhana, it's an even a new bliss again, even more powerful. And the name of this bliss is rapture and bliss, born of seclusion. That's the name of this kind of bliss. Vivekaja, Piti Sukha. Born of seclusion, because it's born of the seclusion from the five senses and the five hindrances. You are secluded from these things. Yeah, it's as it says at the beginning of that formula. So this is literally the name of the bliss, and it is a very, very high and advanced kind of bliss that you go through, you get to at this point. And then you have this idea of while placing the mind and keeping it connected. This is vitakka vichara. Savitakka savichara you have up here. Yeah, and so this is then the last remnant of the movement of the mind, the wobble of the mind, before this is given up completely in the second jhana. Because it ends in the second jhana, it means the first jhana is the most refined kind of vitakka vichara that is possible to have. Yeah, because it ends in the next jhana, this must be the most refined kind. And the most refined kind of these things is not thinking in any ordinary sense. It is just this wobble or slight movement of the mind, which is the precursor or the necessary cause of all thinking. That is, you know, you can't think without movement of the mind. Thinking, by definition, is movement of the mind. That is the first jhana. I'm going to go through it fairly quickly, so please feel free to ask questions. You can write them down. We can take them later on. Let them focus on mindfulness of samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing, yeah, if you want the first jhana. Now, if you wish, as the placing of the mind and keeping it connected are stilled, may I enter and remain in the second jhana absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of samadhi, with internal clarity and confidence, and the unified mind without placing the mind and keeping it connected. So here, the vitakka vichara, yeah, they are calmed. So in other words, they come to a stop. They have the word vipassamade, which means to calm or stop things. So you're stilling the movement of the mind. And because the mind is completely stilled, this is called absolute samadhi. This is why this is called samadhija pittisukha down here. The pittisukha born of samadhi. The full samadhi means the mind is no longer moving. It is fully unified, fully stilled. Yeah? This happens for the first time in the second jhana. And this is why it is called here, it is called ajatang, which means eternally. Sampasadanang means confident. So you have internal confidence, and that internal confidence is confident means that you don't have the first jhana, because you have the wobble there, it means that you're not confident in the object. The mind doesn't go fully into the object. But when you have the full samadhi, that is just another way of talking about the confidence of the mind entering into the object completely. Yeah, that's why it's called that. Chetaso ekotibhavang means unity of the mind. The mind is completely unified. And this is kind of the weird things about these states, is that they are called unification of mind, ekatta, which means oneness of mind. It means that there is no duality anymore. It is a non-dual state, advayang states, where there is no observer and the object are now unified into one thing. There is no distinction between object and observer anymore. There is only one experience, and that is what is the meaning of samadhi. And this is why these states are so profound, because it feels the whole world is unified. There is no duality. There is no distinction between you and anything else. So you have become God, right? Yes, here I am. I am God. And it's almost like a natural conclusion. If you believe in God, it is a natural conclusion to draw that. Because you already have a predetermined view about what these things would mean. And so you can't see them clearly. And this particular happiness is called the rapture and bliss born of samadhi. It's one step beyond the previous one. The previous one was born of seclusion. This is born of samadhi. Even a higher kind of happiness and bliss. Yeah, even more powerful than the previous one. So that's the second jhana for you. It doesn't stop there. Let them closely focus on this samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. Now, mendicant might wish, with the fading away of rapture, may I enter and remain in the third absorption, where I will meditate with equanimity, or where I will stay with equanimity, mindful and aware, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones declare. Equanimous and mindful, one meditates in bliss. So now the rapture fades away. Yeah? Remember the previous one, it had the rapture and bliss born of samadhi. Now the whole rapture disappears, and what is left then is only the happiness part. So the rapture disappears. When that disappears, you have equanimity, mindful and aware, and you are personally experiencing bliss, or directly experiencing bliss. The Pali is kayena patisang vedayang, sukkang kayena patisang vedayang, and it is often translated as experiencing bliss with the body, which is completely misleading. Because again, this word kaya, especially the instrumental ending ena, the ena ending you have here, I should point it out to you, kayena, this ena ending, when it's given like this, means an immediate, direct, or personal experience of something. Why is it called that? Well, the reason it is called that, because you have taken away the rapture, and when the rapture is gone, yeah, the piti is disappeared, the fading away of rapture, you are left with only the bliss. It's the first time in your life you feel bliss without rapture. Personal, direct, immediate experience of bliss. That is what is going on here. And the Aryans, yeah, the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful, you meditate in bliss. So before that, this, you're not really blissful. Now you're blissful for the first time. Yeah? After experiencing the most bliss you think is possible, you find one higher level of bliss. And then finally, the noble ones are satisfied with you. Now you finally experience the real deal. Even though you thought you already couldn't take all the bliss, now you have kind of... So again, it's like the Buddha is very understated. Yeah, now, only this is called bliss. When you kind of reach the highest bliss that is possible to experience by a human being. There is no bliss beyond this. Next one is the fourth jhana, it's equanimity. This is the highest bliss that can be experienced by a human being. So third jhana. Amazing path, isn't it? We've been talking about bliss now, bliss, 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 one after the other. It never seems to stop. Isn't this kind of a cool path? It's just really attractive. Who doesn't want this? It's like, wow, the Buddha. That's kind of how you feel after a while, right? It's just, wow. It's kind of hard to, you can't put words on it after a while, because it's just, how can you explain like all of these blisses, one more than the other one? It's almost impossible. You run out of words after a while there. I don't know how the Buddha can explain these things, but it's kind of extraordinary. So that's the third jhana of you, the highest bliss in samsara. So what happens after the highest bliss? The highest bliss is not the highest happiness. That's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? There is a higher happiness than bliss. Bliss is just the beginning. Okay, let's go on. So let them focus on the samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. Now a mendicant might wish, with the giving up of pleasure and pain, and the ending of the former happiness and sadness, may I enter and remain in the fourth absorption, without pleasure and pain, with pure equanimity and mindfulness. Let them focus on the samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. Giving up of pleasure and pain, you may wonder, why is that stated? And the reason why is because sukha has not yet been given up. Yeah, the sukha is still there in the previous one. And sukha and dukkha, they are like, go together. They are like a pair. So you only fully abandon dukkha when you also abandon sukha, because they come in a pair. So when sukha is gone, then the opposite dukkha is also completely abandoned. So you abandon both pain and pleasure completely together. Now you have gone fully beyond that pairing, right? That's kind of the idea here. As long as you're still attached to sukha, then dukkha is not far away, but when you give up that completely, it's completely gone. The previous abandoning of happiness and sadness, well, this was the piti we saw before, the happiness of the mind, and the opposite, when the piti is there, Dormanasa, the sadness is not so far away, so that has already been gone. So now all happiness, all suffering has been completely transcended and gone. And that is why the mind is extremely powerful at this point, yeah? Because you have no longer any attachment, any interest in any kind of happiness and joy. Yeah? Happiness is now beyond, left behind. Now you have pure equanimity. Pure equanimity is a higher kind of pleasure than bliss. How can you understand that? Impossible to understand without experiencing it. Yeah, it's just impossible. How can equanimity be a greater pleasure than bliss? Very, very hard to understand. But that is basically what the Buddha is saying. Yeah? So you just have to do it. You're going to do it? You've got to do it after this, right? So this is kind of this is where we do these kind of things. Yeah. So those are the four jhanas. So they are mind-boggling things. But it's not the end. Then we carry on. Now, a mendicant might wish, going totally beyond the perceptions of form, with the ending of perceptions of impingement, not focusing on perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, may I enter and remain in the dimension of infinite space. Let them focus on the samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. So, going beyond all perceptions of form, yeah, so there is a slight echo of the idea of form still present in the fourth jhanas. And that echo, and you don't really know what it is, I can't really understand it again without experiencing these things. It's very hard to know exactly what that means, but there's an echo left over of form, yeah, the rupa in those realms. That is then abandoned completely, so now all the form realm is left behind. Now there's only immaterial ideas left. Ending of the perception of impingement. Impingement goes with the idea of form. Impingement means that something is hitting you, and there's no more of this kind of resistance or hitting at all. That comes with the idea of form. Again, I must admit, I'm not entirely sure how to understand this, but it's there. So, not focusing on perceptions of diversity, the mind again being very completely unified, all of these things have been given up, and all you are aware of is the idea that space is without limits. Unlimited, unbounded space is what this is about. I'm not sure if I like the translation infinite, because infinite gives the idea that something goes on forever. It is more like it has no bounds. There is no particular limit. Yeah, if you try to find the limit, you can't find it. And this is what this really is about. This is the base or the dimension of the space, of infinity of space. So, even more profound than the fourth jhana. Let us carry on. Now mendicant might wish, going totally beyond the dimension of infinite space, where that consciousness is infinite, may I enter and remain in the dimension of infinite consciousness. Let them focus on the breath. So now it is not space that goes on forever potentially, it is consciousness that has no bounds. What is the difference between boundless consciousness and boundless space? How are these experienced differently? I don't know. So just going to carry on. Going totally beyond the dimension of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing at all, may I enter and remain in the dimension of nothingness. Let them closely focus on the samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. So here you are aware that there is nothing. So what does that mean, to be aware that there is nothing? How is that different from actual nothing? So there is some kind of awareness. It is not infinite consciousness. It is not infinite space. It is just awareness of nothing. It's kind of mysterious, isn't it? And then comes even more mysterious things. A mendicant might wish, going totally beyond the dimension of nothingness, may I enter and remain in the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Let them focus on the mindfulness of breathing here. So you perceive that there is neither perception nor non-perception here. Okay, I'll not even attempt to comment on that. I'll just Now a mendicant might wish, going totally beyond the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, may I enter and remain in the cessation of perception and feeling here. Yeah, let them closely focus on the mindfulness of breathing here. So this one is a little bit easier to comment on because it's a bit more obvious what it means. Here everything comes to an end because perception and feeling, when they end, consciousness itself ends. The mind comes to an end. Yeah, and when the mind comes to an end, this is the highest kind of tranquility, if you like, that is achievable. And when you come out of this particular state, this is where you are going to be the most peaceful you have ever been because of the complete ending of things. So you enter the state, and because of past momentum or whatever, eventually the momentum of peace stops, and then the mind re-emerges again. Consciousness comes back as a consequence. Because the momentum of peace has a certain ending to it. It's kind of amazing, isn't it? Everything can stop. It's kind of remarkable. Nothing is left. The mind has temporarily suspended. Okay. There's still more to go here. When immersion due to mindfulness and breathing has been developed and cultivated in this way, if they feel a pleasant feeling, they understand that it is impermanent, and they are not attached to it, and they don't take pleasure in it. So now we are back to the arahant, yeah? So you may have gone through all of these things, or you may not, but you are an arahant. This was kind of one of the main purposes of the Anapanasati practice, was to become an arahant. And this is how the arahant experiences feelings. Yeah, they know that there is a pleasant feeling, and they, regardless of what that pleasant feeling is, even if it is one of the highest jhana states, they know it is impermanent, so you don't attach to these things. And this is very hard, not to attach to these things, because if you experience the greatest bliss you have ever experienced, the natural inclination of the mind is to attach. But if you understand that it is impermanent, you know attachment is going to lead to dukkha, and so you don't attach. This is kind of the power of the arahant. They don't take pleasure in it. And if they feel a painful feeling, they understand that that too is impermanent, that they're not attached to it, and that they don't take pleasure in it. If they feel a neutral feeling, even the higher fourth jhana and beyond, they understand that it is impermanent, that they're not attached to it, and that they don't take pleasure in it. Yeah, so even the very highest feelings that are available, you don't take pleasure in any of these things, because you know the moment you do that, you have a problem here. If they feel a pleasant feeling, they feel it detached. If they feel a painful feeling, they feel it detached. If they feel a neutral feeling, they feel it detached. You just know it is there. You don't take it as yours. It is just nature taking its course. You see your own five khandhas as nature, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, it's no different from just nature doing stuff. You don't take it as yours anymore. Just like this table isn't yours, the body and the five khandhas are not yours. Feeling the end of the body approaching, they understand, I feel the end of the body approaching. Yeah, end of body, yeah, okay, end of body. Yeah, arahant is not kind of probably happy, yeah, kind of this bit like a workman waiting for the wages. They're really happy to, the wages are coming, yay, the end of the body, yeah. Feeling the end of life approaching, they understand, I feel the end of life approaching, hooray, end of life. They understand, when my body breaks up and my life has come to an end, everything that is felt, since I no longer take pleasure in it, will become cool right there or right here. Yeah, so when everything becomes cool right here, in other words, everything just ends, everything becomes cool, there's nothing more to take pleasure in, everything stops at that particular point. This is why this, I said this sutta is quite profound, right? It really goes to a long, deep way to some of the deepest aspect of the Dhamma. Everything becomes cool. Suppose an oil lamp depended on oil and a wick to burn. as the oil and the wick are used up, it would be extinguished due to lack of fuel. Yeah, extinguishment. Yeah, nibbayaya. This is the word over here. This is the same word as nibbana. This is why nibbana is extinguishment. Yeah, this is the verbal form. Yeah, so it is extinguished. So this is why extinguishment is the right translation for nibbana, by the way. You can see that now. So that oil and lamp depends on fuel. Yeah, and if when it is all used up, it is extinguished due to lack of fuel. In the same way, feeling the end of the body approaching, they understand, I feel the end of the body approaching. Yeah. Feeling the end of life approaching, they understand, I feel the end of life approaching. Yeah, yeah, the fuel is coming to an end. The remnant of the fuel is it's just the body carrying on until you die. Yeah. And because there is no more fuel to add, there's no craving that adds to this fuel, then of course everything comes to an end as a consequence. They understand, when my body breaks up and my life has come to an end, everything that's felt, since I no longer take pleasure in it, will become cool right here. You're going to be a cool, you are a cool one. That is what is happening here. So this is one of my kind of nice names that I would like to have for one of our monks in the monastery, Siti Bhutto, which means the cool one. And that was a nice name for a monastic, I think. Yeah. So you can have the higher kind of cool, not the lower kind of cool. So anyway, I don't know. I'm not going to comment much more on that. I'll leave it at that. Let's do a little bit of meditation again. Okay. Yeah. So, any questions on this? Okay, that's good. Sometimes the text is so difficult, you don't even know what to ask, because I have no idea where to start. But
I've got too many questions, Ajahn.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, the first one. Does it make sense to relate the different steps to the four stages of enlightenment?
To relate which one to the four stages of enlightenment? Yeah.
Perhaps the progress of the cultivation with a stream enterer versus Sakadagami.
You mean the progress we have seen here? It's difficult to relate because this is a different way of expressing it. But you can be sure that through this process somewhere these things will happen. So the stream entry might typically happen maybe around the first or second jhana. And then the deeper anagami may happen after maybe the third jhana or something like that, and arahant maybe after the fourth. So roughly like that. The deeper the jhana, the more power it has to take you all the way to awakening here. So that would be my brief answer to that one.
Thank you. Because I see it's a progression. Even if we have a glimpse of the first and second jhana, it doesn't just happen like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right?
Exactly. So sometimes you need to attain jhanas a few times before you even get to stream entry, right? Because it's you need to get used to the idea, used to the feeling, contemplate it properly, and all these kind of things. So it's not automatic, these things. Absolutely.
Also, when we say that the 16 steps of Anapanasati fulfills the four Satipatthana, then how would you define Satipatthana? Sati and Upatthana, how do you define it?
I would define that the focus is on mindfulness. Or the application of mindfulness. How to apply mindfulness. Sometimes it is translated as the establishing of mindfulness. The traditional translation is the foundations of mindfulness, which I think is really a bad translation, because that implies that it is what creates mindfulness, if it is the foundation of mindfulness. But the purpose of the meditation is not to create mindfulness, but to use mindfulness towards the object. And that's why I call it the application of mindfulness, because you are applying mindfulness to the object. You're using mindfulness. You're focusing mindfulness on an object. That's why I would say application of mindfulness to me is a good translation here. A little bit similar to establishing a mindfulness. You establish it on the object. So give rise to mindfulness, then you use it to attain samadhi. That's kind of the idea.
You know, one of those Mahasi. Mahasi. Sayadaw Spoller, a Thai monk, and I went to the retreat center, just what they teach, the Mahasi technique, and I went for an interview, and I told him I've been doing Anapanasati, and he said that, this Anapanasati, very few teachers could explain all the 16 steps, what we had here. So that maybe that's why they don't think that it's, it's a good technique, so whatever.
Okay.
So they're chasing Mahasi.
Okay, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that probably means they haven't got so much experience with samadhi, and the samatha is probably what it means. Okay, thank you for that comment. That's interesting.
Ajahn, can I clarify? So after entering the jhanas, the object is no longer the breathing, mindfulness of breathing. But this sutta kept, on every level, it kept mentioning the
breath.
Focus on this immersion due to mindfulness of breathing. Can you please clarify?
So this is what I mean, is that the jhanas come, the 12th step is freeing the mind. That's the last thing you do before you enter the jhana. So the jhanas are not really inside the Anapanasati Sutta. it is implied by the sutta because you're doing the last thing that you do to enter. So as you approach the jhana, the breath is getting more and more faint, but it's still there in the background until the point where you enter the jhana state. Yeah? Once you enter jhana, it's finished. That's why the jhana is not specifically mentioned in Anapanasati. It's only step number 12 is freeing the mind. That's the last thing you do. Then you enter jhana as a consequence of that. Am I making sense? No?
I mean, why does this sutta on, the levels, in each level, like the infinite space, he still mentioned the mindfulness of breathing and subsequent.
I don't think so. Well, you do mindfulness of breathing to get there. So it is like, it doesn't mean that you still have it when you are inside. It just means that this is the practice you do, which eventually will lead there. Yeah? That is different. In the Anapanasati Sutta, it says you breathe in and you experience happiness and bliss. Here it just says that this is the cause for attaining these things. Yeah, so it leads to that. It doesn't mean that you are still doing it when you are in those things.
Monday. Just try to understand the Anapanasati of on meditation. I have to be very careful. I'm trying to quote or understand from the late Mantei Phulaji. So the purpose of meditation is basically mental cultivation. Basically purify the mind. As I understand it, the mind got two parts, citta and manu. The emotional part and the thinking part. The meditation basically is to try to purify the mind by stealing the citta and stealing the manu. So as we go through the meditation and progress through it, we reach first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. There's a citta part. So those, when the citta part is still and purified, we progress to the manu part, the thinking part, which is the infinite space and all that. It's a thinking.
It's not thinking. It's perceptions. You perceive these things. It's like you are just aware that these things are there. Yeah. It's not actually thinking. It's a perception. It's an awareness in the mind. Yeah. So you just know that it's infinite. It's like even if your mind is completely still, nothing. You're not thinking anything. You still have awareness. Yeah, something is going on. So these states are, the mind is completely peaceful, unified, there's no movement in the mind, but you have the awareness that something is infinite. Okay. There's no thinking there. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Ajahn, about the foundation of meditation.
Yeah.
So when the interpretation foundation, you say is application instead of
foundation.
You say that foundation means that it's a creation. But for my space, when I think of foundation, I think it as a base. Is it wrong to think of it as a base?
A base, exactly. So this is the problem, yeah? Because if you say it is the base of mindfulness, it means that it is the thing which leads to mindfulness. Yeah, it creates mindfulness. That's why it's called the foundation or the base of mindfulness. But that's not how it is used in the suttas. They're used in the sense that mindfulness established first, then you use the mindfulness to achieve samadhi. Yeah, so this is why when we looked at the Anapanasati Sutta, first of all it says, Satting Parimukkang Upatapetva, having established mindfulness in front or around the face or whatever, then you start watching the breath. So mindfulness comes first, then you use the mindfulness. That's what I mean. You apply the mindfulness. You apply the mindfulness to the breath. Yeah? That's what I mean by application of mindfulness, or the focus of mindfulness. If you translate the foundation of mindfulness, it sounds like you are doing something which will lead to mindfulness. Difference between leading to mindfulness and applying mindfulness. make sense? Or sorry, please, yeah, please feel free to ask more if it's not.
Because when we use the word apply,
yeah,
so I kind of sense that you use the four foundation is the body, and use the body to apply to
for. You apply mindfulness to the body.
Or apply mindfulness to the body.
Yeah, apply the mindfulness to feeling.
Not using the body to apply.
To make mindfulness. That's what I'm. If you translate it as foundational mindfulness, then you use the body to make mindfulness.
Yeah, I can.
That's not the point. You're not using the body to make mindfulness. You're using mindfulness to focus on the body. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I got that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Achan, is there any difference between citta and mano as implied by this brother? I thought it's the same word for a different word for the same thing.
Well, the answer to that it depends on how it is used in the suttas. It's used in different ways, and sometimes it is used as synonyms because sometimes the Buddha says, "Well, citta, mano, and vijnana are synonyms; are the same, referring to the same thing, which is basically the mind." So it depends in the suttas, they are used in different ways. But they tend to have their own sphere that they are used in. So, because the suttas are very, structured in a sense, vijnana tends to be used in a certain way. So the vijnana is used when you have the five khandhas. And then vijnana is the knowing aspect of the five khandhas. And then you have the other aspect, which are the feeling, the perception, etc. Citta is used as a global term to mean the mind in general. It's a general idea of mind, includes all aspects of mind, and the correct translation is usually mind. Mano is usually used in connection with the six senses. When you have the six senses, you have the eye, you have the ear, you have the nose, etc., and then you have the mind. That's the mano. It is in that context. So it is used as a mind, a separator from the other senses. So they have like their own usage. So they are both synonyms in certain contexts. In other contexts, they are used slightly differently. I'm not quite used to the way you mentioned it before about one being the intellect, the other one being the feelings. I don't know if I would have to look into it to actually look at that kind of distinction. So I'm not entirely sure if I would agree with that, but I can't really say without looking into it more carefully. So. But that's how I would normally distinguish between the three.
Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah. Let's have a break. Can we? It's already 4:15. Let's have half an hour's tea break.